on New Horizons versus Voyager. So are you doing anything about the approximate power output of the RTG on New Horizons? WS2N, K2RAW.
I read somewhere that the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, haven't really changed much in design. You know, they have them encapsulated in these canisters, which they've blown up, they've thrown out of aircraft, you know, they've shot with cannonballs, you know, these things are indestructible. Because they're worried about, you know, when you launch these things or when they make a gravity assist past Earth, you know, sometimes they'll come back a year later and they'll pass Earth. You know, oh no, they might be off and it might come into the atmosphere. We're going to get plutonium all over the place. So these things are indestructible. I think they've used the same design for like decades. And, you know, I think they're all pushing. I think it's 103. I don't know. I got to look again. 103 watts. Capable of you know, of electrical power, where it's like 1,200 watts of actual heat. And now they have three of these things on each spacecraft, on all Voyager, even the Pioneers. They have three of them. So that tells me, you know, you can probably get 300 watts out of each spacecraft. Very similar to same type of thing that's on Curiosity. I think they're in the same ballpark. Back to you there.
So let's run this by again. Is it true that Voyager has two RTGs and New Horizon has three RTGs? Is that approximately true, Paul? Go ahead.
Three on each one. Each one. You can see it when you bring a, you know, close up of Voyager, but then I've also read it, so I've seen it, and I've actually read it. There's three on each. Now, whether they got these things running parallel or series, or you know, any combination of maybe they can switch them back and forth, and, depending on what they want, I don't know. And they all run these 20 volt systems throughout the spacecraft. That's the common number. Back to you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of military electronics that runs on 28. I'm trying to remember now the main supply voltage on the B-1B bomber was 440 volts. Or was it 220? Let me think now. 220. 220, 400 hertz. And that was a change in design from the original 110, which made all the transformers become a lot lighter, higher voltage. No, all the wiring became a lot lighter. And the 400 hertz means a lot less iron is required. And a full phase, a full wave, three-phase rectifier assembly on 400 hertz gives you, is it 1200 hertz or 2400 hertz of output? I think it's 2400 hertz of output when you use both Y and delta wiring. So three RTGs on all of those crafts. And you have reason to believe that in the case of Voyager, they're now 37 years old. Are all three RTGs decreasing in power at roughly the same rate? So in other words, there isn't one that decreased faster than the other two. All three are slowly fading at the exact same rate, and I think the majority of the fade is the actual thermal, the thing that converts heat into electricity. I think those are the things that are really fading faster than the nuclear power supply is running down. Is that approximately true of you, Paul, K2RAW?
Yeah, well, the thermocouples are probably deteriorating, but the average for Voyager, I don't know what it's going to be, maybe for Horizon, maybe they've improved over the years. It's a big difference in decades. But, you know, with Voyager, it's 4%. they shut down that they don't need, assuming that, you know, these are all electric heaters that they have to shut down. Not sure. Now, the way they wire these spacecraft now, they say that they're not really, you know, spending big wires all over. You know, you've got like 10 instruments on board each spacecraft, and they run, you know, very fine wires to each one. And you'll send the main computer will send a code, you know, come on, turn around, relocate, do this, do that, you know, bring on a different system. And they think of it like, you know, I mean, there isn't like wires going to independent relays or, you know, nothing like what they had in the original days. These are like the internet, you know, where they'll send a digital code over to some piece of equipment, and it knows now I got to turn on, or I got to do this, I got to lower my power, I got to change something. It's all modern stuff. Back to you, Dick.
A spacecraft that's out there as far as New Horizons or Voyager is so far away from the sun, you're getting very little solar energy. There's nothing else nearby that's giving you any real amount of heat. The background temperature of space is 3 degrees Kelvin, 2.73. Let's call it 3 degrees Kelvin. So as you get further and further away from the sun, your spacecraft wants to settle down at 3 degrees Kelvin. Except for a low-noise gas-fed front-end low-noise amplifier, very few chunks of electronics like running at that kind of temperature. Certainly a camera wouldn't. So you got to heat everything that you want to run. And now, in the case of Curiosity, the pure heat coming off the thermal generator is being piped around to heat the chunks of electronics. In the case of Voyager and probably New Horizons, the RTG is out on the end of a very long arm, I believe, in order to keep that nuclear radiation away from delicate pieces of electronics. As such, sending back electrical power from the thermal generators, from the thermocouples, is relatively easy. But since the thermocouples are the things that are the thermocouples are a significant portion of the 4% decrease per year, it sure would be nice to use piping to take the direct heat output of the thermal generator and run that past the electronics that you want to keep warm. And Curiosity is doing that. But in the case of Curiosity, your RTG is a lot closer to the mass center of the craft. In the case of Voyager and probably New Horizon, I think the RTG is out at the end of a long arm. To pipe that thermal energy back over that long arm is kind of difficult. If the only way you can get energy out of the RTG is electrical, and you can see that to use that electrical energy for heating as opposed to running a power supply is a kind of an expensive way to go. To heat a chunk of electronics from 3 degrees Kelvin all the way up to operating temperature, that can take a significant number of watts. You might have some opinion on all of this, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, you know, you got the main bus of the Voyager. You know, it's an octagonal shape, and that's really what it's like. Coming out of the side of one of them, man, it looks like about 3-4 feet, less than that. You know, you've got these three RTGs, you know, on that one arm. Not that far from the spacecraft. There are two other things sticking out. One that comes out on opposite of where the RTG is, and that's where all your equipment is, your cameras, and all your detectors. Particle detectors and looking for plasma and all. And then you've got another arm coming out, very long arm, and that's where we have your magnetometer. That thing is, that's always the furthest out. That looks like it's probably 10, 12 feet out. And then you have a long backwards, got your thruster, your main thrusters. And of course, in front of it's got the dish. I think it's around 12 feet in diameter. It's not like you've got this 10, 12, 14 foot arm and then you have the RTGs at the end of that. It's coming off like the main body, right after you come off this octagonal main bus of the spacecraft. You've got a short arm, maybe 3 feet long, and that's where these things are located. Same with the Curiosity, if you look at the back of it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Curiosity, that's where the RTGs are. So it's away from everything, but not completely far, far away. Back to you.
Okay, is there any thermal piping then from the RTGs that are heating up vital pieces of electronics on Voyager? So the thermal piping that you've got on Curiosity on the surface of Mars, do they use thermal piping on the Voyager, to your knowledge?
I've looked close and I've never seen anything like that. I mean, you see the RTGs and the heat is located all over everywhere, each part of, each component, requires some kind of a heater. It must have a half a dozen heaters all over this. I think it's electrical. I don't think they have a warm electric box, or would they? Called it would be a web on a Pathfinder up in the land on Mars. Spirit or an Opportunity. I mean, all electronics, everything was located inside the main body of these rovers. They were taking direct heat from that. Actually, the Pathfinder didn't have a RTG that actually had plutonium inside, and it would heat up. They looked like D batteries, and half a dozen of them. And that's what supplied the heat to Pathfinder, not the Pathfinder, not the one that landed, that stayed there. The rover that drove away was called the Sojourner. So the little rover that drove away had these like battery type things in it, and they looked like and what it was Sojourner. Back in the day.
How could they vary the heat output between a Mars day in summer and a Mars night in winter? Huge temperature difference. So therefore, the amount of heating requirement changes. How did Sojourner adjust for that, if they did, Paul? Go ahead.
I never read that they did. Although I guess it wouldn't be too hard to imagine, but, some kind of a louver opening and closing. But they must let it just run wild. That's what I think. Back to you there.
Sojourner was operational for what length of time? Was it months or years? I forgot. I know it took some beautiful pictures, but how long was Sojourner operational?
That was about 3 months. Yeah, it would transmit that little 440 antenna, 70 centimeters Pathfinder base. That's what it rolled off of. That Pathfinder base had the weather station on it and all that stuff. By the way, they gave the Pathfinder lander a name after it landed. They called the Carl Sagan Memorial Station. So that thing was supposed to work. They would have been happy if they got 3-4 weeks. They got 90 days, I think, out of the Pathfinder. Sojourner.
Now, Sojourner on 400 megacycles talks back to the base, the Carl Sagan base. I think the Carl Sagan base had a slow data rate by which it could, with X-band, talk back to Earth. But I thought the fast data rate is to talk up to one of the satellites, which then transfers the signal back. So there was a double repeat going on here, as I see it. Sojourner to the base station to the satellite, satellite to Earth. Wasn't that the main communication path? Go ahead.
Yeah, but you got to remember, we didn't have all the orbiting satellites. You didn't have Mars Express. You didn't have Mars Odyssey yet. You didn't have Mars Global Surveyor, big one. So you really were depending on the one, and that was called Mars Global Surveyor, which lasted 10 years. That was a really remarkable craft. Orbited Mars all those years. And then one day, you know, after 10 years, due to computer, they sent signals up that they should have sent up to Mars Global Surveyor. Things failed on that. I can tell you about that if you want. But that's the one they were using for the repeater. It's not functional today. Still on orbit, though.
Yeah, you may have told us this one, and I've forgotten. Somebody sent a erroneous message that hung up the computer, and there was no recovery mode. Didn't have a safe mode that it goes into if it hasn't been communicated with for a while. Tell us a little bit more about that one, Paul. K2RIW.
Okay, that was the end result. But what led to that was the commands that they sent. They always want to update the computer and whatever they want to do, and they'll sometimes they want to reorient the spacecraft, and they did that. But one time that they did it, they oriented such that the battery, there were two main batteries on board. The one battery was pointed directly into the sun, and it just overheated. They didn't plan on doing that. And you think of space is being cold, but this thing started cooking into like hundreds of degrees, because one side of the spacecraft is like, you know, what is it, minus 250 or something, the other side is plus 250. Well, this battery cooked, and then the other one had overworked, the other one wound up dying, one thing led to another, and things started failing. It wouldn't go into the safe mode, it didn't have enough of anything left to do what it was supposed to do, so to recover. And but they learned something. They said all future, any other future flights to any planets, we're gonna make sure that this never happens again. We have the battery pointing directly into a sun situation. So I mean, they learned a lesson from it, but they got 10 years out of it. They were only hoping to originally get 3. So they kept renewing it year after year. Got a lot of extended missions.
I should remember, but I don't. Earth is away from the sun, one astronomical unit. Mars, I'm going to guess, is a little bit closer to 2 astronomical units.
Yeah, I think it's 1.6.
Okay, 1.6. As such, the total amount of solar energy getting to Mars is probably one-third. If you and I put a battery in the sun, it would get a little bit hot. If we did it at the Mars distance, I'm having trouble believing that a battery is going to run too hot in the sun at Mars. The solar energy that hits Mars is not that much, obvious by the fact that Mars runs at some ridiculously cold temperature. So how in the world did that cook a battery? Where's the magnifying glass, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's still going to get to 250 degrees, except the volume isn't going to be there. I don't know, Dick, but that's the NASA report, that the battery overheated because it was looking directly at the sun. I read it on another website, I would say, now, but I mean, this was in one of the NASA reports. Next time I come across it, I'll reread it. Maybe they'll tell you what temperatures the battery got up to. I don't know. But it do get enough sun out there to create voltages, that's for sure. Look at the size of the solar panels on board Rosetta. I mean, they've got to be 60 feet each, you know. It's just a tremendous size, but they knew that. They didn't want to make an RTG out of it. They used solar panels. And that's, you know, all the way out, how to operate out by the asteroid belt. Back to you, Peter.
When I'm using solar cells to charge rechargeable batteries, if I don't have an intelligent regulator doing that charging function, I can easily overcharge the batteries and overheat them. So the combination of a battery being overcharged from solar panels plus being in the sunlight, now that combination can be an overheat. But a really good design for a battery charging system has some kind of a thermal sensor on the battery. My charger for my ICOM batteries, I'm trying to look at the model number of the thing, because it's called BC. BC35. It's got a thermal sensor, which is hot. So I guess with hindsight, there wasn't the right kind of thermal sensing. So I'm now beginning to believe that it was a combination of overcharge plus direct sunlight that cooked the battery. That's a guess on my part, Paul. I'll send it back to Paul in a minute, but you guys who are listening, if you've got any further questions on space-like material, give us your call letters right now. And if nobody picks up, then Paul will. So WS2N with a delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Don't hear anybody. I'm sure they must have made corrections on future spacecraft. Point it the right way, maybe relocate the batteries somewhere, make sure they're insulated better. Maybe they put the misters on the batteries, like what you're talking about. They start to get too hot, you know, they'll send a signal to the computer, maybe reorient itself. Who knows? But they did say they learned from that. Any future spacecraft, we're not going to have the same problem. Back to you, Dick.
Now, that particular spacecraft, they got 10 years out of it. The definition of your success probably was like 3 years of service. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, they went 3 years, and then they kept getting, extended missions. They do that with all these things. Including the ones that are up there. Mars Global Surveyor at Surveyor, that's on extended missions. Cassini is on, I think it's, probably four extended missions. That thing went into orbit around 2004, and it probably was supposed to go 3 years or something. Been doing it for 10 years now, in orbit around Saturn.
We're getting our money's worth out of those. And has anyone predicted that New Horizons will also give us 37 years of service like Voyager did? Has anyone made a prediction that that is at least mildly possible? What do you think, Paul?
Yes. There's a long-term plan for that thing. And they'll communicate that with that one. No, I remember reading it, but, you know, probably for another, you know, 3 or 4 decades, I guess. That thing's young. That's only 10 years old, right? Just making that out to Pluto now. I think the Voyager 2, didn't that finish up in 1989, passing Neptune? Wasn't that the end of their planetary mission? That would make it like, what, 10, 20, 25 years old, 25 years since finishing their last planet. Wow.
I believe you've told us in past weeks that the prediction is that Voyager, they'll still be able to communicate with it until something like the year 2022. Is that roughly the number, Paul? Voyager will still be talking back to us very slowly?
I remember it was at least 2024. And I remember that because that's also the predicted date right now without extending the time for the International Space Station, 2024. But you know that's going to go on.
If they did want to discontinue using the International Space Station in 2024, I mean, this is by far the biggest chunk, the highest chunk of electronics, chunk of hardware, the highest number of pounds, the most amount of kinetic energy. How in the world do you safely deorbit all of that stuff? I mean, putting it up was pretty clearly defined. Taking it back down, that ain't easy. I'll bet you there's nowhere near as thorough a plan for deorbiting all that stuff as there was for orbiting it. Is that roughly true, Paul? K2LAW?
eBay's going to sell it, Dick. There you go. Well, that's what happened to me. And that was, what, one-fifth of the weight? There you go. And did I tell you about the Strato launch vehicle? I think I mentioned that last week, Dick, right?
Well, was the deorbit of Mir really thoroughly planned, or did it just happen? And this other craft, go ahead and tell us about that one, Paul. Go ahead.
I know they reoriented it the best they could to catch the most of the atmosphere to try to burn this thing up. But some parts made it down and over the Pacific where, you know, chance of hitting any kind of island or land is pretty much zero. Not zero, but close to it. I remember the pictures of that thing coming down. And that's what they'll have to do. It'll be a bigger blast, you know. The International Space Station, over 1 million pounds. And that's the weight, that'll be the weight of this Strato launch vehicle being built out in California. This thing is going to be a carrier. It's going to have six 747 engines attached to it, three on each wing, two fuselages, and in the middle, it'll be carrying a launch vehicle probably built by Orbital. And on the front of that, now there's plans now that they're making a deal with Sierra Nevada to use the Dream Chaser spacecraft, put that into orbit with up to three people, up to three astronauts on board. Their original plan was to have seven astronauts launching on top of an Atlas V rocket to the International Space Station, but that's kind of like been canceled because NASA has decided to go with SpaceX and with Boeing. But they got this thing half built, the Strato launch vehicle. It makes the White Knight look teeny tiny. That's the one that they launched from for Virgin Atlantic back in there.
I guess I'm a little bit in the dark on Strato launch. So if I understand correctly, the beginning of its launch, it's an air breather, and later on it uses rockets. Is that roughly what happens?
It's going to be the world's largest airplane. That's the cool part about it. It's just a six 747 engines. It's like taking two 747s and, you know, welding the two wings together, and now you got two you got a fuselage on the left, a fuselage on the right, and then to the far left, three engines, to the far right, three engines. So this thing's going to have all kinds of power, and it'll go up to like 50,000 feet with, you'll be able to put, rockets into orbit. You put a real rocket in the middle of this thing, it'll drop and then take off, and it'll be able to put stuff right into orbit. The Strato launch vehicle will come down, land in a runway, ready for the next launch. It's one of those deals. But it's so big, the craft with all the fuel in it and everything is going to be over 1,000,000 pounds. When I think of that, it'll be the same weight. This flying thing, this carrying thing, will be the same weight of the International Space Station. Thank you, Dick.
What is the intended service for that pole? Is that intended to move a whole lot of people in a hurry? I mean, once you build a craft that big, yes, it can carry a lot of cargo. But if it's carrying people, can you really plan on that number of people that want to go to the same place at the same time? Open your pole.
It's a rocket. It's a rocket launcher. That's it. And if you happen to put on the front of the rocket another spacecraft called the Dream Chaser, now it's going to be a rocket to launch people. And they have to downsize. They plan on eventually putting 7 astronauts on Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser is the one that was originally supposed to go up like a little space shuttle and come down and land on a runway, similar to the X-37B, the one I was just talking about earlier. And then that, you know, that's the one by the government, by not NASA, but the Air Force, and about that size, a little bit bigger. And you put that on the front of say a Pegasus, similar to a Pegasus rocket built by Orbital Science. Put that whole construction on, attach that to the bottom of the straddle launch vehicle instead of, you know, on the bottom of a B-52. Straddle launch vehicle is bigger, much bigger than a B-52. Bring it up to 50,000 feet, drop the whole assembly, you know, the Dream Chaser and the Pegasus vehicle. Let the Pegasus light off, send it almost into orbit, and then have the Dream Chaser light its engine to finish putting itself into orbit. And then it can go any way you want, you know. Back to you, Dick.
Space is great stuff. I'm trying to remember now. Who really kicked us into this? Kennedy? When he said we're going to land a man on the moon and bring him safely back. That certainly was a big kick. The establishment of NASA in roughly 1958.
Not to get Von Braun.
Oh, yeah. Von Braun, the Saturn V, Sputnik. So a combination of Sputnik, Von Braun, NASA, and Kennedy really kicked us into space. Those are the major players in the beginning from one point of view. Is that about the way you see it, Paul?
To APG with a quick question.
Go ahead, Dave.
You look at this. Let's have a military type of thing. Manned orbiting laboratory. There was plans for that. They had astronauts for that. That's what he wanted to go with originally. So he pushed for that. Next thing you know, you had Sputnik and Vostok 1 with Gagarin. And I still say he shouldn't get credit for being the first guy to go around and land in his spacecraft. You know, sure, he did the orbit, came back, but you know, he came down on a parachute. They ejected him out of his spacecraft. But he didn't come back with his spacecraft. I mean, it came back, but if he stayed with it, he would have been banked up. They didn't have it that well designed. I don't know. That don't count. Back to you, Dick.
I used to get Goddard, too.
Oh, yeah. And Dave, we'll get to you in a second. Are you saying Yuri Gagarin didn't come back with his spacecraft? Did I misunderstand that one?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the plan was. And they kept it a secret a long time. But, you know, the plan was come back down, you know, get a couple of miles above the ground, and, you know, hit the button and jump out of this thing, and come down in your own parachute. And that's what he did.
But he certainly did go to space. How he comes back down, isn't that a minor detail? What made you think that doesn't count, Paul?
there was some kind of society, you know, you have like, I forget what they call it, you know, like have the International Astronomy Society, you have a group, I forget what they call them, and they say that, you know, to, if you make an orbit, or more than one orbit around Earth, you're supposed to come back with your spacecraft to complete that, you know. Not land in a, you know, farm field and, you know, run up to the phone and tell the people I live there. I gotta call Moscow, you know, pick me up. That's basically what he did.
But 99% of his deorbit was in the spacecraft. The spacecraft did everything except the last, let me pick a number, the last 200 miles an hour, which was done with the parachute and him independent of the craft. That's close enough to landing with the spacecraft from my point of view, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, it is. I'm just trying to take it away from the Russians. But, no, yeah, I mean, the guy had a lot of nerve. He'd sit on this thing and go into orbit. They didn't know if his retinas were going to fall out. They didn't know what was going to happen to him, you know, physically. So, I mean, the guy, he did have a lot of nerve. Back to you.
And I think as a test pilot, he did pass away some number of years later. Dave, into APG, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and Paul, and John, and Wales. Just a quick question for Paul regarding the space station. This has probably been covered in the past, but I don't remember. How do they, as the orbit of the space station, you know, deteriorates and it gets lower and lower, how do they boost it back up higher? Does it have built-in engines, you know, that have to be refueled, or what's the method?
Yeah, the first, actually, the first two pieces that went up was Unity and Zarya. That was the Zarya. They call that the functioning cargo block. So those two pieces docked, the American piece, the Unity, and the Russian piece, the Zarya. Then the first real living quarters that came up with the bathroom and kitchen and all, and place to sleep, was Zvezda. That was launched by the Russians on a proton rocket. And that was the next piece that came up in that dock. Now you had three segments up there. The back of the Zvezda has rockets. And that is their main functioning rocket system even today to push the space station into a higher orbit. And what they'll do is bring up a cargo vessel similar to a Soyuz vessel called the Progress, and unmanned, and you have two different types. One comes up with mainly food supplies, scientific equipment, and this and that, and then fuel, and they'll load the fuel externally to the tanks on board Zvezda. Then you have another Progress mission that might come up, which would have, you know, food and everything, but it'll have a lot less of that, more fuel. And again, that'll load fuel into the system, into the Zvezda, and also fire its own rockets. And you'll fire the Progress rockets. Let me drop it. And that will push the station forward as well. And it's always, you know, they always dock it in the back of the Zvezda. Another one that presently is attached to that same docking port is the ATV, Automatic Transit Vehicle. It's the same, similar type of deal, and that's launched by the European Space Agency out of South America. And that's much bigger than the Progress vehicle. That's got a lot more fuel, a lot more supply and everything. So that does the same work. The shuttle used to do it, and that used to get it up around 14 miles. Progress, I don't think, could do that. But, you know, they have a couple of, go up two, three, maybe four a year. So it adds up, and they try to keep up with it, I guess. Also, let me drop it. Those big solar arrays rotate, and aren't really being used. If they're in dark, they'll make them edge on, and this way any rarefied air that's coming up won't hit the solar panels to slow them down. So a lot of different ways to try to keep them in altitude. And actually, they always push it forward. You know, you're in orbit. You keep this whole thing. You know, when you go to a higher orbit, that's why you always push it from the back. It's not like, you need rockets on the bottom of the space station. So that's pretty much how they do it. Back to your WS flat.
Yeah, you're always doing a prograde boost to go to a higher orbit to compensate for air resistance. Even though it's up so darn high, there's still a little bit of air slowly slowing you down. The amount of thrust you can get out of the thrusters that are on the International Space Station, I'm guessing, is a little bit smaller compared to the thrust you can get out of a shuttle when we used to use it, or to the Progress. So Progress and shuttle probably do it for a shorter period of time, but I'll bet have a lot more thrust capability than the thrusters on board. Is that true, Paul? K2LAW?
Yeah, I don't know the numbers, though. And I think they had rotate the whole space station 180 degrees when the shuttle did it. Because the shuttle was always docked in the front of the space station. So that was a little bit different, but the main way of doing it now is the way I described it, as far as I know. And that's been working okay. I mean, they're keeping them where they have to be. We're a little worried about this problem after Columbia, 2003. Quite a few years without the shuttles going up. They wanted to make sure there was going to be extra Progress missions going up, but I guess they've got it covered. And Dick, I don't know the numbers of which ones are more powerful or how high they go up. I think the last time I saw anything was the Progress got it up 6 miles or something. Back to you, Dick.
The latest piece of hardware that West bought, brand name is Canberra, if I understand correctly. He's got a neutron detector and a gamma ray detector. Pretty fancy piece of hardware. I'm guessing, Wes, this is a rather new acquisition. I also sense that you've got a small sample of cesium-137, and the detector shows a response to cesium-137, which is a little bit different than expected. Is that approximately what that latest email is saying? WS2N? Here we go. N2XJN, K2LIW, you there, Wes?
Yeah, N2XJN. The device was almost not used. Usually, the device needs to have a calibration, every device of this nature. The calibration is being done by the very simple procedure. You put the source, which actually the sources are to be obtained. But this thing is much more advanced. It doesn't have a source, although you have a full calibration feature which actually requires the source. Let me jump. And the whole deal was that I put the sources in, and there was no proper recognition on the source of sources. So eventually I was able to negotiate a price for it. The device was used only a few times and is extremely pristine condition. What it does is it gives me full gamma spectrum analysis when used with the proper spectroscopy software, and I have all of the disk for it. It does have interactive spectral analysis, efficiency correction, nuclide identification and quantification, but not only by the intensity, but also by the energy level. It is based on sodium iodide with thallium. That means that it's not high purity germanium detectors where the peaks are narrowed, but that one has to be cooled with liquid nitrogen. It does have a library coloration traceable to the bureau, which gave me not only the peak, but also the peak compensation with the background. So if, let's say, I have a number of different isotopes and some of them are hidden, they still to be found in the background. Then interference correction and a tri-dimensional geometry composed, that is one of the softwares in it. It does have a distinction between power and Dora decay correction. That means if you have a short-living isotope, like the medical isotopes, few hours, and then it decays to another isotope, then it gives me that distinction, so I would be able to trace what actually was the parent, what was the daughter product of. Minimum detectable activity calculations, and those are according to ISO norms, compliance and everything, gain adjustment. It does have a few modes, and those few modes are dose mode, which actually gives me only in different kind of chosen by me form how big is the dose per time, and that it also gives me the locator mode. Locator mode is pretty nice because I can pinpoint the presence of extremely small items. Nuclide ID mode, which actually I could have a microcuries or PQLs, and that gives me activity calculation of the isotopes and spectroscopy. Tutorials is on the touch, and the screen is touch touch, but my finger is too big for it, so I have to use something like a small wooden stick for it. In spectroscopy mode, I see physical geometrical representation of the given nuclide. So if I have a cesium-137, it does have extremely characteristic form, or say cadmium-460 or 59, or whatever is there, I have six of them. Then of course, even without the identification, I would be able to know what it is. That's absolutely beautiful device, but I have a few other subjects to discuss. We have a few minutes left. One of them is actually sent by Roy, and it's an extremely interesting subject. And there was the other one. I was on the workshop. There was a Hewlett Packard. Hewlett Packard was sold to Agilent, and Agilent was sold to Keysight. So Keysight right now is teaching about everything you want to have. That means spectrum analyzers, vector network analyzers, and at that point I would like to say thank you. It's the first time I'm telling that. Dick, for tell you something, yes, you've been teaching, and you had a number of people who were interested with what you're doing, more or less. But I believe strongly that you have created extremely big interest in science, in technology, in knowledge. And it is not only you. I would like to thank you. I would like to thank Roy, Glenn, Eric, John. You have actually made me this way. I had my prior background from Poland, but when I was there, I was strong. I was really drunk. At the first break, I've got an offer from one of the companies, job offer. And it's just, the guy says, well, you're brainy, and would you like to work with us? And you probably know that company, I'm not going to tell it in here. Then on the second one, I've got an offer from military to work with them. The strange thing was because they told me, are you interested in some kind of job with us? I said, well, what should I do? She says, well, I cannot tell you that. And right now, Mike, to you. So you actually, I said to John, you created a creature. You guys created, you made somebody smart enough. There were people from all around the world. There were people from China, from Korea, from, I don't believe it's from Japan now. Nobody was from Japan. And I was really drunk, Dick. So I do thank you again. Back to you.
You gotta be careful how you use some of my words. I've got lots of opinions on lots of subjects. Sometimes I'm using common sense in areas where I don't have a whole lot of experience. So, like many people who are interested in science, we all have a certain batting average, hit rate. Nobody bats 1,000. We don't get it right all the time. But a person who really understands science knows that you're never going to know it all. You got to be a little bit humble and realize you're going to make some mistakes. Periodically, people are going to correct you. And you can either take that as an insult or realize that, hey, this is natural and just go on. Let me ask you about the detector. You've got a neutron detector and a gamma ray detector as part of this Canberra machine. Canberra, I think, is the brand name. A space Canberra. I'm wondering, are those two detectors a kind of scintillation counter? In other words, does the detector contain a crystal that when a neutron hits it or when a gamma ray hits it, it gives off a small amount of light, and then there's a photomultiplier connected to that, and the photomultiplier tells you how bright, how long, and by that you determine the spectral signature. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. So are those detectors sort of a scintillation counter, or are they something else? Over to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. The device has two separate detectors. Usually it comes with one detector, so which is a scintillating detector, that's right. But the good thing about it is composite, temperature composite. So mostly when you do the calibration procedure and you are in the room and then you have to go out, that calibration varies. Now that is probe that is there is being called smart probe. It actually adjusts all of the variables due to change of the environment, and it keeps calibration valid. It does have a library. I have no how many. I don't know how many. I have it only since yesterday night when I came back from Rhode Island. But I believe 250 of pretty much common isotopes. And automatically you put anything there and it's going to identify and gives you the full information about it. Also about the energy. So it's full qualification, qualitative and quantitative scoping. In addition to it, you have options, and one of the options is neutron probe. This is differential gas field a probe, extremely sensitive. So you have a nuclide that gives you also neutron counts that will react on it. And those two are connected this way that Let's say you want to operate mostly with gamma, then the gamma detector is on the cradle, connected with the wire, and that wire is connected not directly to the device, but to the neutron probe and to the neutron probe, because the short cable is connected to the device. So you can have it handy in your hand, you can operate it, but if you want to concentrate on neutron counts, then you have to put the whole device next to the specimen. It's extremely interesting device. With all of the whistles possible, you could imagine. Another option is software. I've got four pieces of software with it, and that allows me to do all kinds of tricks with it. One of them is a special composited probe software. The other one is the gamma analysis software. Another one is the basic spectroscopy software and documentation. And another one is the software that allows me the communication with the device. It's fully operated with networks, USB, anything you want to, and to exchange.
Yeah, this is a pretty nice-looking piece of instrumentation. I'm wondering how you found this. I guess it's possible that one of your friends knows the kind of things you're looking for and said, hey, I've got the thing you're looking for. And somebody's not making a great use of it, and you can make him an offer. That's a guess on my part. I know that one of the experiments you've done in the past, where you put, I forget the name of it now, but you put various levels of chemistry in a vial and expose it to 400 megahertz RF energy, and so now you have the ability to find out if neutrons and gamma rays are coming out of that reaction, which according to the original author is believed to be nuclear. And I know that some people have been expressing some doubt as to whether or not that's a nuclear reaction. Now with this machine you can measure whether or not neutrons or gamma rays are coming off the reaction. I'm guessing that's one of the things you intend to do in the future. Is that possibly a true, Wes, in 2XJN, K2LIW?
That's right. Actually, I did have a means of measuring that before. The name of the gentleman who made in 1956 the patent for it was Coleman and Gillespie. John knows better exactly how to pronounce that. And those guys have made a very short 2.5-inch tube with approximately 2/8 in size, and it does have a powder in it. The powder is pretty much like a 1901 Thomas Edison battery. And there was a guy named Hendershot who in 1928 found that being next to this spark transmitter, he was producing electricity. And there was a resonance circuit and the battery, pencil battery of this time. And there was some kind of notion with it, but then 1956, similar kind of device was presented by these two gentlemen. One was English and the other one was Canadian. Then I started to play with it, and I claimed that I got the phenomena on the table. I had a number of devices before, although this kind of device is a good toy and it's beautiful. Better one.